Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
It is WPVC, the home of all Maynard Ferguson all the time. It is not Rick Moore, it is Sean McCord, your much more than monthly substitute host here on the Sunday morning wake-up call. And I'm sitting across from my friend, Matt Marshall. Matt, we've only known each other a little over a year, but it feels like longer.
Absolutely.
I have that effect on people. Well, we have so many things in common. Matt, you are a film lecturer. I'm going to have you give your official title, even though you emailed it to me last night. You're so much smarter than I.
I don't think we have enough time for me to... to give my current title. Geez, what am I? I am a film lecturer. I teach film studies at the University of Virginia.
I've heard of that. It's right down the street.
Right down the street. Mm-hmm. Nice school down the street. And I also teach for the Hollins University screenwriting program, the MFA program down in Roanoke, for which I'm also a graduate. It's a great summer program. Mm-hmm. You know, you can get your MFA over 3 summers. The playwriting program as well.
Shout out to Todd Ristow and the playwriting program at Hollins.
Absolutely. Come down to Southwest Virginia over the summer and get a master's degree. It's fantastic.
Frequent listeners of the show, of which there are Dan behind me,
Hi, Dan.
know that a recurring motif of mine is I want to get people in here to talk about a life in the arts that have been, those are the kind of guests that I really like to have in here. One, because this is something that I had to figure out for myself, how to have a job, how to have a family, how to be a part of a community, and yet also pursue those things that are interesting to me and fulfill me. And because I have this vision of sort of this, you know, mythical young person, you know, huddled under their blankets, listening to the radio in the dark, thinking, I want to be a writer. I want to be an actor. I want to be a filmmaker. But I'm stuck here in a small town in Virginia. How do I make that happen? And this is how we make that happen. So that's what I want to talk about. You are originally not from Virginia. You probably can also get a little closer to your mic.
Okay.
There.
All right.
You are not originally from Virginia. You are from infamous, will you tell
yes,
me?
Yes, I'm a Long Islander.
Long Island.
From Levittown, Long Island, of Bill O'Reilly fame.
Bill O'Reilly fame. And post-World War suburban building sprawl thing.
Exactly. Yeah. The one of the first suburb. You know, some people claim the first suburb.
Right.
Also, Eddie Money fame, Two Tickets to Paradise.
Oh, and see, I didn't know that.
Maybe Hold On to Me. And
so your high school reunions must be really interesting.
That's right. So no, I think it was a great place to grow up. I mean, being in New York, the radio culture. Mm. I mean, there was just so much music. And having, you know, baby boomer generation parents who were really into movies, it just was the perfect school to learn a lot of music and see a lot of films. Martin Scorsese talks all the time about the Million Dollar Movie being his first film school, this show that would run the same classic film for a week straight.
Right.
So, I grew up in that you know, post-Million Dollar Movie, but it was still the same kind of environment, you know, classic film really being emphasized.
Yeah. We had a Million Dollar Movie, too, out of a station in San Francisco, where I grew up in the East Bay Area, and that was my introduction to a lot of early classic films as well.
Yeah.
And there are kids all over the country. No, what am I talking about? They just stream everything now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So, and you're also a musician and I guess I call you film composer.
Yeah. I've been specializing mostly in film scores, silent film scores. I think I was born at the perfect time. It was that last gasp of only being able to see films pre-video, pre-home video, going to the theater, and then having to wait a really long time before they might show up on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember my very first feature film was Star Wars, 1977.
Mm.
That was my first, you know, theater experience. How do you top that, right?
I can't. We're done.
Right. So, as you can imagine, you know, John Williams, you know, hearing film music in a theater for the first time, it being John Williams, who very much represents that last generation of kind of classically influenced composers. Hearing that married with the visuals of the film, and then MTV happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I was right there when that went live in August of 81, and
when it killed the radio star.
That's right. Yeah. Interestingly enough, I think what it was MTV, seeing the Queen video for Under Pressure, the Queen David Bowie
King
song.
King David Bowie, yeah.
And they used clips of Nosferatu in that video. I think many of us first became aware of Nosferatu through that Queen video. And it was like, what is that film? That looks really creepy.
All right, so Nosferatu, for those of us who, for our listeners who went around in the 1920s, was an early classic science fiction, horror gothic by F.W. Murnau,
right, if I'm saying that right. Adaptation.
It's an adaptation of Dracula, mm-hmm. spooky as heck, mm-hmm. and all German expressionist silent film. It's all done with sets and makeup, mm-hmm. and you watch just a few seconds of this thing, and it's really unlike anything you can do in film now, because if you tried to do that in film now, it would look corny and hokey.
Mm-hmm.
But because of its roots in its times, when the German Expressionism was making the transition from stage to screen, it was genuine and it was sincere, mm-hmm. and people were seriously freaked out by this thing, this character with his long drawn face and his long fingernails, and wandering through this castle, which looked like sort of like two dimensional stretched into three dimensions, and long staircases and shadows and doors coming out of nowhere in odd angles, just beautiful stuff.
Mm-hmm. And there'll be an opportunity to get spooked by it again at the end of October, because I'll be performing a score for it at the Paramount Theater. So
nice plug. I actually didn't know that.
Okay. So. come on to the panel.
That's a Sunday
afternoon.
So full circle. So when is that?
That will be October 30th. That's mm-hmm. a Sunday afternoon at 2:00 at the Paramount.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be me at the keyboard, kind of oscillating between organ and piano, and some string players. I'm getting some violinist and a cellist to join me.
Oh, that is awesome. Okay, yeah. So as long as you're doing plugs, tune in to the Wake Up Call at 11:00 that morning, when I'll be interviewing Jody Kubasa and Wes Harris of the Virginia Film Festival, which is coming up the week following. And then turn off your radio, hie thee down to to the downtown mall, to the Paramount, and see my guest, Matt Marshall, play music for the screening of Murnau. What for screening of Nosferatu by F.W. Murnau. What a perfect Sunday.
Yeah.
Skip church. You've just got time to go to Bodo's between the end of this show.
Right.
2 hours, it's just enough time on a Sunday to get through Bodo's and get to Paramount for the screening.
Absolutely.
Okay.
We'll love
right.
to see you.
All right, enough plugging. Sure. So how does a boy from Levittown, New York, break into the film biz?
Yeah. So, between, I was talking about music video, this seeing music videos and then seeing my very first silent film, around 8 or 9 years old.
Do you remember what that was?
It was Hunchback of Notre Dame, Lon Chaney.
Yeah.
It was on PBS one night, and it was sort of the both extremes, both ends of seeing a longer work, with continuous music,
mm-hmm.
and then MTV were just these 3 or 4 minute bits of imagery over music over imagery. So it created this spectrum of interest of like, wow, the idea of doing continuous music over imagery, and it affected me in a way. I found it fascinating. I found the movement, the aspect of almost dance. Silent film is like dance. It's somewhere between dance and pantomime theater and art.
Right, because it is so theatrical, because the cameras are so big and heavy they couldn't move them around.
Right.
I mean such a contrast to, as you say, the 3 minute music video where they can't linger on any single image for more than 10 seconds.
Right.
I mean, 10 seconds is a long time.
Right, yeah.
We're talking 2 or 3 seconds. And then these silent films with these long, languorous shots.
Yeah.
It was practically a stage play because once they set these things up, they couldn't move these cameras around. You know, actors moving in and out. And also, I'm sure you read this too, there was concern in the early days of films that when you cut away to a close-up or you cut away to a different scene, that audiences would be confused by it.
Right, right.
That their minds wouldn't be able to process. It's like, well, wait a minute.
Yeah,
we were in this room. Now we're on a boat. Right. How does that happen?
Right.
It's the devil's work.
Right, right. Our minds would become unhinged by changing the camera. Yeah.
Right, right. So, now it's completely the opposite. If you show anything for more than 3 seconds,
people will turn the channel.
Exactly.
That's right. So, yeah, the whole attention deficit problem. But I just found it fascinating. And so we'll say that was a seed was planted that would not take root until I got to college. You know, I was sort of the typical Long Islander, kind of growing up on, classic rock.
Hanging out with your buddies at the malt shop.
And the malt shop, yeah. I was a guitarist first. There was a piano in the house, and I knew very early on that I could replicate what I heard. You know, I had a good recall, and I could find the notes and I could find the sounds by ear, which is sort of a blessing and a curse, because then when you try to read music, you just don't have the patience. I mean, eventually I did learn to read music because I have to write music for my other players who don't play by ear, who need music. So I did eventually do that, but it was very frustrating for me to look at black notes and know where my fingers were supposed to go when my ear worked very fast. So, most non-classical musicians are like that, though. We're ear players. I played guitar. I played, I had a brief band in high school. But then when I got to college, I went to SUNY Albany, State University of New York in Albany, started to take more serious composition lessons there, and then met Arthur Lanig, Bela Lugosi's biographer. Arthur Lanig taught film studies. He was the old school tradition film studies, where you watch the film once and you talk about it. There's no pausing, there's no frame by frame analysis. You just watch it once and talk about it. But he knew Bela, and I'd seen Dracula, when I was like 10 or 11. There's a group of us that talk. If there's something about seeing Dracula when you're 10 or 11 with Bela Lugosi, you get it. Mm. You're young enough to still be creeped out by it, but you're old enough to sort of appreciate it. If you see it later, you'll think it's corny.
Right.
Or if you're younger than 10, you'd be too young to watch it and be patient with it. But to be taught by Bela's biographer was just like amazing. Arthur Lanig was really into silent film. And it really into Lon Chaney. And so that sparked my interest again about, I love music. I hear things all the time. I'm sort of creating music in my mind all the time. Wouldn't it be great to marry these two loves and start putting the music to silent films? And the good news for me was that most silent films didn't have official scores. It fell on the theater that was showing them to get some musicians together, compile some things that sort of work over the moods of the different scenes. So it's just this open invitation for new composers to bring, new music to these classic films.
That's probably something worth mentioning for those of you who aren't steeped in film history, is that the silent films originally, when they shipped in the silent era, 1919s and 1920s, they would just ship the film to the theaters, and it was up to the local theaters. Now, some of them did have sheet music that came with it.
There were compiled scores.
Right.
I mean, some of the more prestige. I mean, there's some famous, Birth of a Nation, Fritz Lang's Metropolis. Even Nosferatu had an original score initially. We don't have most of it. It's because that was an unauthorized film, and it had to be destroyed. Technically, it was supposed to be destroyed. A lot of material, a lot of history about that initial screening was lost. So most films, just fell to compiling music that would work.
And it was very much a community experience. Local musicians. We all picture sort of the somebody sitting at a giant organ. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't true in movie houses across the country, you know. And sometimes it was just bring in, Bud and Emma and, whoever else and local musicians, and they would come in, and it was more like a theater experience.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Film grew up as a theatrical experience, which is great to remind people of that.
Mm-hmm.
The first celebrity film magazine was called Photo Play, right? A reminder that it's the visual and the theatrical aspect of this new art form. It's great to bring people back into the theater to watch movies in a theatrical setting. But it had to be frightening, too, for directors to send their films out not knowing what the heck people were going to put to it, And I'm very mindful of that. I totally try to be anonymous. Like, there's a wonderful anonymity to silent film music in that the best compliment I can get is, Matt, I had no idea you were even playing. I just was absorbed in the movie, right? Whereas I've seen a lot of experimental...
Which is just not normally something a musician wants to hear.
Right. No, it's sort of like...
I just sat through your whole show. Were you playing?
Were you playing at all? Yeah. No, I know I did my job. If you were lost in the film, then mm-hmm. that's great. Because, I've seen a lot of musicians, avant-garde style, they do their music and just happen to have a movie playing in the background, but they're really kind of front and center. Sometimes that works. Sometimes that could be an interesting night. But if you really are supporting the film, you want to try to capture the tone of the movie, be appropriate to kind of what's dramatically going on. So I try to do my best at doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Probably the biggest such, melding of music and film that I ever saw. Mm-hmm. This was 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Remember when Francis Ford Coppola resurrected Abel Gance's Napoleon?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
I went to attend a screening in L.A. I want to say the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, because this thing was... They had to have three screens and three projectors because there were parts of the film. The film would start initially on a single screen, mm-hmm. and then when they went to the battle sequences, they would light up the other projectors, and we'd have sequences happening on the left screen and sequences happening on the right screen and sequences happening in the middle. Sometimes there were different colors, might be a battle sequence in tinted in red going on one side, and a little moment between two people tinted in green or yellow on the other side. Yeah. And then you had this orchestra. You had this 100-person orchestra in the middle, and this went on for 4 hours.
Yeah, it was extremely ambitious. I'm actually very envious that you got to see that production, because that was decades in the making, trying to bring Abel Gance's original vision. That triptych. His version of CinemaScope.
Right.
Three screens instead of one wide screen.
Yeah, and that is something that I'm sorry, but no matter how good your home theater and 4K TV screen and Blu-ray player is, you are never going to be able to recapture that moment.
Yeah, incredible.
My guest is Matt Marshall, a lecturer in film at UVA and at Holland University on WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. It is a Sunday morning wake-up call. This is Sean McCord with my guest, Matt Marshall. So, Matt, when last we left you, mm-hmm. you were at SUNY Albany, and you were figured out that you wanted to somehow meld your love of film and your love of music. How did you get from there to Virginia?
Right. So I decided to transfer, actually, after 2 years in Albany, transferred to Mary Washington College. It's mm-hmm. not a university.
Mary Washington College.
That's right, in Fredericksburg. And I just knew that I would do better in a smaller environment, smaller school. And they happened to have, at the time, in the mid-90s, this was Laserdisc time, by the way. This was, the the clunky record
this
size.
This is something else we're going to have to explain to people.
That's right. Yeah, so there was this brief period where we had record album size.
Right. Okay,
DVDs,
first of all,
basically.
What is this record album? Yes.
Right.
So I still have a few Laserdiscs at home. So that was when we were making the transition from home video VHS tapes mm-hmm. to to there was a unspoken demand for something higher quality. Mm-hmm. So films were released on laser discs, mm-hmm. which were basically CDs, but what am I saying? 7 inches, 8 inches?
Yeah, I mean, they were
the size of LPs.
Yeah, the size of an LP.
And you'd have to put them in special players. Mm-hmm. By the way, we still have LaserDiscs and LaserDisc players at the UVA library if you're really curious about the technology. And you would put in the disc, watch the first half of the film, and then have to take it out and turn it around.
You would flip it like a record.
Yeah, my favorite were the machines that would flip it for you.
For you. That was a huge deal.
So it would come up, right. So the drawer would pop out like a robot arm and go, yeah. And turn over and, you know, shoot back in, and you'd only, you know, it looks like you'd have like 30 seconds of dead air.
Yeah.
But what was great about these was that you know, what we're used to now, but was so new to us then, was you could have alternate tracks, soundtracks, you could have commentary,
right.
You'd have little mini documentaries. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was a big deal.
This was the beginnings, right.
When these first came out in the 90s.
Absolutely. So, I went from Albany, which was looking at, you know, real 16 and 35 millimeter prints, going from that to then LaserDiscs, that was the big thing. Our professors insisted we had to see the LaserDisc version. There actually are some films that only exist still in LaserDisc format. It's not a format that is completely irrelevant. I remember forever, you can only see Magnificent Ambersons or Eric von Stroheim's Greed on LaserDisc.
Right.
Or VHS.
I really wish I'd gone out and gotten some of those.
That's right.
I'm embarrassed to admit the kind of crap that I actually do have on LaserDiscs.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I had kids at the time, so they were like Disney films.
Yeah, oh, exactly. So, I finished out my undergraduate at Mary Washington, did a interdisciplinary degree in art history and film studies.
Mm-hmm.
They had a liberal studies program that you could do, and I just, you know, I'm sort of one of those people that just have so many interests, and, you know, what am I going to focus on? So what I got from Albany was just seeing the continuation of the film tradition as part of the art historical tradition, rather than part of the dramatic tradition or English literature. You know, film classes are still taught out of a lot of English departments. You know, a lot of different departments sort of claim film to be mm-hmm. their offspring, you know. So I came from an art historical background, so I appreciated that. Coming from Albany, and then of course at Mary Washington.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, film is its own art, yet it is a melding of so many things. It is, you know, it starts out, traditional narrative film starts out as a script, so you mm-hmm. have to have writers.
Right.
But film is so many other things. You can have documentary. Mm-hmm. You can have Andy Warhol setting up a camera on a street corner of New York and people passing by, the infamous film Empire.
Right.
It's a film.
Right.
You can't really argue with
right,
it.
It
is a film. But it's, you know, so it is a blending of literature, of the dramatic arts, mm-hmm. like theater. There are so many technical, you know, with lighting and sound, mm-hmm. and all, you know, sort of all the behind-the-scenes stuff that you shouldn't see but are part of the film experience. Mm-hmm. That was when I was young man in my community college days and realizing this is something I'd really kind of like to formally study too. I was, you know, I had taken some film classes which were taught by the drama teacher.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and yeah. You're right, they're often taught by English teachers.
Mm-hmm.
But here you are at
at Mary Washington.
There's so many
bounced around a lot, Sean, so don't
there, well there don't there, are, there are so many Marys.
There's a lot of Marys.
There's a lot of Marys.
There's something
a lot
about
of,
Mary.
And Marys
right.
and Williams.
Marys in Virginia. That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah,
very
Mary,
popular.
Mary Washington,
yeah.
Up in Frederick, Mary Washington College.
Mary Washington College. Yeah, I could have. Yeah, I guess I could have gone to Mary Baldwin. But yeah.
William and Mary.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Having that art historical background,
mm-hmm.
really. I've always emphasized the visual aspects of it, but you're absolutely right. It's the perfect film is the perfect integration of all the arts. something that Richard Wagner actually would have been probably very proud of. He sort of started this whole notion of with his music dramas. That's actually the next big thing, getting into Wagner's music. His music is so cinematic. You can almost talk about him as the grandfather of cinema score, because you listen to his music and you know what's going on. You just know from the motifs.
As Leni Riefenstahl will attest.
Right, yeah. So there's just this, and there's this compositional tradition that really is, you know, steeped in Wagner. And so, I guess I became seduced by his music, and that kind of informed a lot of my, like, thinking about composition, thinking about creating motifs for certain characters or certain, but how did I actually get into this? I mean, first it started off with just sort of sitting in my office watching movies while I sat at my keyboard, you know?
Yeah.
That's how it all kind of begins, just on your own, making up music as you watch films. In, say, 2001, I was working, you know, I had a day job. I was working at Westminster Canterbury of the Blue Ridge here in Charlottesville.
So you ended up here in Charlottesville.
I did, yeah. Yeah, my wife and I, we left Fredericksburg and came to Charlottesville to pursue, more education and job opportunities. And I just happened to be out, you know, just right out of graduation. I did actually have a film job. I developed X-ray films at a medical imaging center. I always say, well, it was a film job,
right,
you know.
Right.
But that was just sort of sitting in the dark, waiting for films to be passed into the dark room, and then running them through a machine.
This is 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. You are listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. I'm Sean McCord, and I'm sitting across from Matt Marshall, who is taking us through his life in film that brought him here to lovely Charlottesville, Virginia.
Thank you, Sean. So, yes, when we left off, I was in the dark room waiting for X-ray films to come through. And my wife and I, we decided to move to Charlottesville because I had a medical background in terms of jobs. I ended up at Westminster Canterbury.
Mm-hmm.
And the then director of the Virginia Film Festival, Richard Herskowitz,
mm-hmm.
was coming to Westminster to plug the Virginia Film Festival. And he started talking to my wife and just happened to need someone who could do music for the screening of Phantom of the Opera, Lon Chaney's Phantom of the Opera. He just happened to need someone.
You know? This just happened to come up in conversation. Just,
yeah, I mean, how often, when in history, after 1929, has anyone ever needed an emergency silent film musician? You know, the first in almost 100 years. So there I was. I said, I didn't really do it. I wanted to do it,
mm-hmm.
and like
mm-hmm.
be paid to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get out of my office at home and do it for real. And so I said, yeah, sure, I do that. And so Richard took a chance on me, and
yeah.
From then on, I just...
What was that first screening at the film festival?
That was the Phantom of the Opera.
Right.
Down at the Regal
mm-hmm.
Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the then Regal.
Then Regal Theater,
yeah,
right.
Violet Crown now. But, so they set me up with a keyboard. Yeah, I didn't even have a proper keyboard at that time. They had to sort of wrangle something for me to play in the live audience. But it was really exciting just to sit there and be part of... You know, to collaborate with these great artists from the past, you know, and I didn't have to ask them, can I? You know, the director needed me too,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, just to be, you know, just to have this dialogue between this great work of art and how it inspires me to create music and try to, you know, create the right atmosphere for it. And so I loved it, and, you know, I've been doing it ever since.
So I was there at that screening. Do you recall what kind of reception you got afterwards? How the audience responded, and did people come up to you?
They did. Yeah, they did. It was, you know, I mean, they might have just been being nice. You know, I don't know. People are very nice.
Well, people are very nice. But yeah, when they go out of their way to say something,
you have to
assume it's genuine.
Absolutely. Yeah.
No, it's not like you stood at the door and didn't let people exit until they said something nice to you.
Right, right, right. Exactly. Yeah. Although that's not beyond me to do. It's not beyond. But no. I think had I crashed and burned or.
Well, that would have been awesome. We'd still be talking about that.
Yeah, no, had it been a humiliating experience, yes, I would have remembered that. But no, I have very good memories of it, and I got good feedback. And, you know, I probably was the most critical of my, you know, my performance, and my wife as well, because she knows, knows music, and she sort of, but, you know, thank goodness for her criticism. You know, it's definitely helped me improve. And I, it was my first gig, so I learned a lot. But yeah, I think it went really well for a first time. There was sort of a sense of just letting go and just you know, getting into the film and just trying to listen to what the film was directing me to play. You know, so yeah, it was very, very exciting. So
you've been continuing to do that, not every festival.
Yeah. I mean, I had a pretty good unbroken run. I've only maybe missed two or three festivals in about a 15-year period.
Yeah.
But I've been to William & Mary for their Global Film Festival. Down in Roanoke, they have a historic theater, the Grandin Theater, you know, with gargoyles and stone walls. It's a great place to see a classic film. So I've done some work down there.
So I want to give a shout-out to a mutual acquaintance of ours, Robert Israel, because the field of silent film composers and musicians is pretty small.
Yeah, it's a niche, right. It's a niche group.
Yeah. So Robert and I went to UCLA together. This story is absolutely relevant to nothing, but Robert once brought me a comic book. We're talking 1982. He once brought me a comic. We didn't know each other that well. Mm-hmm. But he said, I bought this for you because I just got a feeling that you would like it. And he was absolutely right. I had stopped reading comic books when I was about 12. Mm-hmm. And he showed me this thing. And it's like, wow. You know, this was in the early 80s when comic books were starting to be published on like really nice paper. And you could only get them in. It was the early days of the direct retail. Mm-hmm. And he told me about the Golden Apple comic book store in on Melrose Avenue in L.A., and I went down there, and I got hooked all over again. And years later, when I moved to New York, I ended up working at the Forbidden Planet comic book store right there in Greenwich Village, and really all traceable to Robert Israel coming in, throwing a comic book on my desk, saying, I think you'd like this.
Yeah.
So there are just moments like that, so just moments of propinquity. Mm-hmm. When we were talking about this before you came on the air, when things just say, this is something that you ought to be doing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're just sort of called to it. That reminds me of just, you know, you talked about being in New York. Before I moved to Virginia, I had a good stint at working at Tower Records in Long Island. We had a very large, you know, of course, the New York City one is very famous, but we had a really, really large one in Long Island. And I worked in the classical department for a year. And that was just amazing, just to work in a department. The classical department probably was, you know, as big as Crutchfield, just the classical department.
And
just to be part of that tradition of sort of specialists, and you know, you would go to the store and someone would take you and recommend things.
Yeah, I think we had this discussion because I had a friend who was the classical buyer at the Tower Records in New York. Where was it? I don't remember. Greenwich Village.
Absolutely.
And I mean, they had classical music experts.
Right.
And you'd walk in there and they could help you find anything.
They let you play things. You know, so I learned a tremendous amount. It became great.
8th Street. It was on 8th Street.
8th Street, yeah. 8th.
Yes.
8th.
The late lamented Tower Records.
Yeah. It's an amazing story. Yeah. Back when, you know, music was physical, you know, it was more hands-on. But that was a great opportunity to listen to a lot of music, mm-hmm. A lot of different styles within, you know, just to realize just how broad classical was, from, you know, avant-garde experimental music, you know, Stockhausen and John Cage, and you know, back to Bach, and even, you know, Renaissance music, ancient music. You know, I'm really into Greek, you know, early ancient music, Greek music. Hmm. There's just such an amazing spectrum within classical.
I should have had you bring some discs in. We could fill some time playing music.
Some music, yeah, yeah.
On the Sunday morning wake-up call, where actually we just talk. 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Sean McCord with my guest, Matt Marshall. Okay, so we've gone all over the map. Matt, from New York to Albany, mm-hmm. to Fredericksburg, mm-hmm. to Charlottesville, to composing music for silent films, mm-hmm. at the Virginia Film Festival, because of a conversation that Richard Herskowitz had with your wife.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And, you know, the message in this is, you know, there's only so much you yourself can do.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mix of persistence, and a little bit of providence, or a mm-hmm. little bit of luck, however you see it, being at the right place at the right time.
And just being available and open to opportunities.
Yeah.
And this is something that, I mean, every person I've spoken to on this irregular series of mine about a life in the arts has a similar story, where something happened and they said, wait a minute, I'm just the right person for the job. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's however you want to look at it, you know, whether it's, you know, sort of, you know, some sign of force sort of moving us around, or in my view, it's you've been preparing all your life for an opportunity that you didn't know was coming.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So everything that you do in an area that interests you, mm-hmm. can make you be that right person at the right time.
Yeah.
And that's why you don't give up. That's why, you know, if you're interested in art, you know, if you're interested in illustration, learn more about that. Get to know the names of your predecessors. So when one of those names comes up in conversation, you go, hey, I know a little bit about that, mm-hmm. or music or film or drama or theater or English or whatever it is. Just be that person who has those nuggets of knowledge and can do those special things. And when that door opens, you can step right through it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, it's particularly with the arts, it's rare that they try to find you. Initially, you have to really do it yourself.
And your ears have to be perked up for that conversation,
yeah,
happening next to you.
Absolutely. And you have to be willing to put a lot of time in, you know, pro bono, you know, just the experience.
Yeah.
Just be willing to just get your work out there, create the events that you maybe that you wish you were invited to, create your own event and make it happen. And meet people, and it's through connections with people that, you know, I mean, I will never get rich playing silent film music, you know, in 2016. That's not the point of it. But, you know, the ability and the opportunity to sit in a room, you know, with hundreds of people and share an artistic experience together, you know, you can't put a price tag on that. I just, you know, I love doing that. And you'll get to a point where the time that you put in will kind of come back. It's like, you know, planting a seed and taking root. And then you'll get to the point where you can start turning things down. It will happen.
Yes.
You know? But in the beginning, you say yes to everything.
Yes. Know? Yeah. There's a great point when you can start saying no to things.
Right. Right. Right.
My guest saying no is Matt Marshall, film lecturer at UVA. Mm-hmm. We'll get to how that happened in just a moment. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. It is the Sunday morning wake up call on 94.7 WPVC. This is Sean McCord. I've been calling myself the substitute host, but I'm here so often I'm starting to feel like the alternate host. I'm sitting across from Matt Marshall, currently a film lecturer at UVA, but this was not your first time at UVA. Now that we have the advantage in this wonderful little town of ours, mm-hmm. of this great university down the street that attracts and absorbs artistic people. So you were a lecturer there many years ago. Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
So I was still at Westminster Canterbury, mm-hmm. sometimes doing silent film music right. on the side. And then I thought I would give the PhD program in music composition a go at UVA. I decided, I want to get back to school. Well,
you want to be a doctor.
That's right.
Make your mother happy.
Doctor of music. That's right. Prescribing music for people. Music therapy, I guess, right?
Listen to this. Beethoven.
That's right. there's a piece for every ailment. So, as it turns out, the year I applied, the only traditional composition teacher, Walter Ross, mm-hmm. of the old school, of the, you know, the concert hall tradition and melodic music, was retiring. And UVA's push was for electronic, computer music, new music. And they said, thanks for applying, Matt, but we just don't have faculty that are interested in symphonies and concerto and, those sorts of things, huh. And I have a great appreciation for computer music and for new compositional practices, but that just wasn't, in my heart, the kind of music I was hearing.
Sure.
So it was basically a thanks, but no, thank you for applying, but we just don't have anyone here that does that style. So it was sort of back to the drawing board. So I went back to a day job, a wonderful job over at Procurement Services, where people buy things, where all the departments come together to make purchases and to bring speakers in and make things happen. So I found out about Hollins University's Master of Liberal Studies program. Like, oh, this is perfect. Another Liberal Studies a la carte program, which will allow me to kind of bring my interest in opera and film and everything together.
And is this one of the summer programs or is the academic
year?
That's what I thought.
It actually goes year round.
Yeah.
And, bless my wife. She just totally said, Matt, go down there. Do get your master's degree. It sounds like a great idea. It will allow you to bring these projects, experiment with a lot of different kinds of projects. So I got that first master's degree, and then the School of Continuing and Professional Studies was having these personal enrichment mm-hmm. course programs. So mm-hmm. it's people from the community that want to learn a little bit more about a topic, no grades, and that was a foot in the door. They hired me to teach film appreciation classes. And, I did that from 2007 to 2011, and I had a nice steady group of people from the community that would take the class.
So just talk a little bit about that. Yeah. So someone takes one of those film mm-hmm. appreciation classes. Mm-hmm. These are, what do they call them? Community scholars.
Yeah, the community scholars.
They just want to learn a little bit about film.
Absolutely.
They're not trying to take your class from SCPS and go down and break down the doors of Hollywood.
Right.
What were you teaching?
So what I was teaching was giving them a historical perspective of the art, mm-hmm. How it grew. So we would always start with the silent era and kind of move decade by decade through the major periods of film and, intense formal analysis, helping them to look at things like composition. Why is the shot composed the way it is and how does that affect the meaning and the way the shot's lit and, the blocking, where the characters stand and what they're wearing and how it just sort of all the, all the things that are, I guess, supposed to be transparent. We're not supposed to notice those things because we're so lost in the illusion of film. And these appreciation classes were sort of breaking some of those things down and seeing how an editor comes to a film, seeing how a director approaches a film. So, they were getting history, stylistics, becoming more aware of how to read the image. Because film is very passive. It's very easy to sort of sit passively and be absorbed by it. But, now they were kind of on their edge of their seat looking and trying to, what our colleague Todd Ristos says, observe for meaning.
Right.
Always observe for meaning. Why are those things in the frame? How are they commenting on the characters?
Because film, especially, because there's so many people involved. There's cinematographers, there's lighters, there's directors. Mm-hmm. and editors that nothing you see on the screen is an accident.
Right, right, exactly. And it's all too easy to sort of sit back and think nothing is happening until the first character utters a word.
Right.
And there could be a whole lot going on before the first character speaks, you know. So so just giving them those visual tools and things that, you know, to look for, becoming more sensitive to the soundscapes of films, the amazing things you could do with sound.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much, you know, I'm a film composer, but there is so much overscoring. You know, leaning on the music way too much to, you know, for a quick shortcut to an emotional.
Right. Right.
You know,
feel sad here.
Feel right. Yeah. This is how you should feel right now because of this, what I'm playing. So, less is definitely more, you know, sparse, judicious, scoring. I very much appreciate. I mean, there's some films that certainly call for, you know, a grander score.
And these things come in waves. I mean, mm-hmm. if you pay attention to the history of the film, I think now we are in a period where we have filmmakers who are relying more on the visual, mm-hmm. relying more on the cutting. But, you know, films that you and I grew up watching from the mm-hmm. 60s and 70s, and even into the 80s, especially in the 80s, mm-hmm. they relied so heavily mm-hmm. on the film score because it's like it was how they knew how to produce emotion in people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, knowing when to hold back. You know, one of my favorites, I mean, to give you an example of something where the score is so important,
mm-hmm.
Bernard Herrmann's score for Vertigo.
Well, Bernard Herrmann's score for anything is important, but you're right.
Yeah, particularly Vertigo. You could almost argue it's a music drama.
Mm-hmm.
You could listen to the score of Vertigo and know exactly what's going on. And in fact, the music is telling you much more about the psychological states of the characters and things that they're remembering, things that they're regretting. And so that's amazing, you know, when a composer can do that. There are very few people that can. So, yeah, you walk a fine line between being too prescriptive of how the audience is supposed to feel versus really contributing to the narrative and to the subtext of the artwork.
So at some point, your little gig at SCPS,
right? Yeah. Became full-time down in Holland.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. They had an emergency with a faculty member, and they called me up to see, what are you up to, Matt? And, you know, can you get down here and cover some classes?
I mean, so they must have had some sense of that you were teaching, that you were in Charlottesville.
Yeah. They knew. So it was sort of, these things helped each other. Getting a master's degree mm-hmm. opened up the door to UVA.
Right.
Teaching at UVA mm-hmm. opened up the door to being a full-time teacher mm-hmm. at Hollins. Being a full-time teacher at Hollins is now come back full circle to being a full-time, more of a full-time teacher at UVA. So these just things just helped each other out, you know, in terms of experience and having graduated from Hollins' MFA screenwriting program. They knew me, and also the Master of Arts in Liberal Studies, both those programs. The faculty knew me, and the students knew me. So,
That's important. I want to hit that nail again for just a moment. You graduated with an MFA in screenwriting. You did not pack up your bags and move to Hollywood to become a famous screenwriter.
Right. Yeah. The wonderful thing about my experience down in Hollins was just all these UCLA and NYU faculty come to Southwest Virginia, to Roanoke, to teach for the summer. And they were all telling me, well, yeah, you could move to Los Angeles. You mm-hmm. might have a better chance of running into someone that could do something. But in the age of the internet and the age of, you know, shooting PDF files, you know, anywhere you need to, you know, it's not essential that you be there. You know, you just have to put a little extra time in. And, you know, I knew Charlottesville is a wonderful writing community. It's a wonderful artistic community. So, you know, if I need to be out in L.A. or I need to be in New York, it's not bad at all. I'll just hop on a plane. I could be there pretty quickly. So.
Yeah, that was something that struck me, and I wasn't aware of mm-hmm. when I first started going down to Hollins. Longtime listeners of the show, of which there is Dan, know that mm-hmm. I shout out to Dan Gould, my producer behind me. pushing buttons. Thank you very much. know that I'm in a summer graduate program down there in playwriting. And I was aware of the film and screenwriting program, but what I didn't know until I got down there was how many UCLA people are there. Now, I went to UCLA Film School last century, many years ago.
Okay.
So that connection for me is entirely coincidental, and yet there it is. My own past coming to haunt me again.
That's right. Yeah, the return of the repressed. Absolutely. So it was just a great opportunity to meet people from the West Coast and in the age of the internet. Yeah, it opens up a lot more flexibility in terms of where you can do your work. You know.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Well, speaking of which, let's talk about the web series, because I want to do a shout out for that, whose title is, we had to look this up before the show.
Oh yeah, Speak for Yourself.
Speak for Yourself. So you were teaching film again at Hollins this summer, and some of the students had this crazy idea to do an entire series, a web series of, what was it, 6 short films?
Yeah. They were in development. The scripts were in development in the spring, and then production. Then they went into production for the summer. So, you know, the students who did it, they registered in the spring and wrote the scripts for credit, and then they took those scripts and went into production over the summer.
And they did it. And I'll tell you, because I have conversations, you know, with the film students there. I'm in the theater program, but I have conversations with the film students because, normally they're horrible people and we don't communicate
That's
with each
right.
other. But having feet in both worlds, I can kind of bridge that gap. And I know that one of the things that the film students who would come and see some of our theater events, one of the things that they envied about us is that we could just do it.
Right.
We could just get a bunch of people in a room, write a script, throw it up on stage, have an audience. It's done. And whereas film is so much more complicated. And they kind of took that spirit. And in the course of 6 weeks, they made this 6-episode web series. Mm-hmm. And it's online now on Vimeo. Give us the title again, Matt.
It's called Speak for Yourself.
Speak for Yourself. And there are actors in the web series who are also our actors on stage who are getting their drama certificate, who are doing stage work with us as well. Actors are, man, they are the hardest working people.
They are.
Because I was working with some of these people who were, you know, rehearsing with us. Mm-hmm. And getting their lines down for our plays, and then going and shooting this web series, and shot in the dorms there in Tinker, at Hollins, where we were all living, and they did it, and it works, and it's a beautiful little thing. So go into Vimeo and look it up. Give us the title one more time.
Speak for Yourself.
It's just a perfect example of the kind of creative work that can come out of a place like Hollins,
and a great collaboration with film and theater, which I would like to see more. I'd like to see the screenwriters and the playwrights. Come together a lot more.
We can
learn a lot from each other.
If anybody can make that happen, you can. Are you going to be back there next summer?
I think I will.
You think you will?
I think I will. I hope.
You're waiting for the invitation to come.
If the invitation comes, and
so we call them a series of unfortunate yet also fortuitous events happened, and brought you back to Charlottesville.
My wife and I had decided we wanted to come back to Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
I was finishing up my contract with Hollins.
And how long had you been there?
Five years. I was just on my last year, and thought, let's go back to Charlottesville. And there were some screenplays I wanted to finish up on, and because that my training is in screenwriting, and so I had kind of neglected that. When you get into academia,
it's
very hard to find time for your, for your own projects. So we came back, I was teaching the summer session, and my mother passed suddenly. Some people might know Lorraine Ryan, a retired English teacher in Orange County High School, just crossing the street and was hit by a car. We say this all the time. You never know. You might just be crossing the street and get, sometimes you get hit by a car crossing the street.
Yeah.
It happened to my mom.
Yeah.
So,
during your last week at
Hollins.
Hollins,
So I had to, I had to hurry back up here, and I'm an only child, and my mom's single. So, yeah, just you're so busy, just trying to get things done and doing what you have to do when something like that happens. And then out of the blue, the phone rings, and UVA has an emergency with a faculty member. Matt, what are you doing? Can you teach a class for us? And then I got a call from the English department. Matt, can you teach a film class for us? So the death of my mother, and then the hiring of me in this emergency circumstance. Yeah, this is a pattern with me. Beware.
We were talking about this on air. Before we came on air, you're like the emergency instructor mounted on the wall behind glass.
Right, yeah, in case of emergency, break glass for film professor Matt Marshall. Yeah.
So again, you had... people knew your name. Mm-hmm. They had they knew the kind of person that you were and the kind of thing that you could do.
Yeah.
And because of the work that you had done before, and so when that door opened, there you were.
Absolutely. And I think a special thanks to Jody Kilbasa and Wesley Harris, because I believe that they had name dropped to Colleen Kelly, the chair of the drama department, as a potential person to consider, because they knew my work. That never would have happened had I not, started in my bedroom keyboard playing along with silent movies, right? It just, everything is connected, and you just, you have to be patient, you have to be persistent, you just never know when your niche thing, that's another thing too. If you can find a niche thing, mm-hmm. Everything old is new again. That's a real pattern. Things that are, radio drama, may come back, or it's coming back.
I'm right there, buddy.
That's right.
I'm right there.
You just never know what art forms might come back, and just keep at it. Don't give up. And it's just an amazing, amazing story.
Just find what you love to do. Mm-hmm. And it will become the thing you do. And it's not, whether you chalk it up to providence, mm-hmm. whether you chalk it up to good luck. My personal feeling is you make your own opportunities by making yourself that indispensable person, mm-hmm. by knowing what you know, by becoming good at what you do, or at least sometimes even just good enough. So much of my personal journey has been, I may not have been the ideal candidate, but I knew what I was doing and I was good enough and I was ready to step in and learn and become the best person in the room. Mm-hmm. And that's the message that I want to hit over and over again, with these series of occasional talks with people who've done that very sort of thing. Matt, thank you so much. For coming in. So you are now a film lecturer at UVA. Hopefully I'll see you again next summer at Holland. We're both planning to be there.
That's right.
And we may see you playing music again at an upcoming film festival.
Right.
We don't have the schedule yet.
That's right. And Nosferatu at the Paramount.
On October 30th, right after, of course, tuning into the Wake Up Call that morning and mm-hmm. Listening to Jody Kilbasa and Wes Harris of the Virginia Film Festival. Absolutely. See, it all connects.
It all connects.
Thank you very much for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, listeners, for listening. This is 94.7 WPVC. This is the Wake Up Call. If you want to hear this again or want to hear it for the first time, go to SeavillePodcast.com, where my buddy Dan Gould here behind me posts all of these shows. We will see you back here on another Sunday morning Wake Up Call.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.